Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Actually delivered talks and discussions on the role of churches in the American Revolution, women in the Revolutionary War, farming during revolutionary times, and indeed the whole notion of what your teacher didn't tell you about George Washington. Clearly, you've carved open a whole range of aspects. When you then got on from that to actually produce the epic Westwood sagas with Spring House, Adam's Daughters, Children of the Revolution, and of course, Comanche Trace. Clearly, all's coming across well. And we're delighted now to be able to welcome to the program our ace writer extraordinaire and creator, and indeed historian, the wonderful David A. Bowles. How are you, David?
Well, it's something that I've been a part of for quite a few years. I grew up on a ranching family in Texas and always around cattle, livestock, and now I'm living in town and I'm in an apartment with 100 other folks and share, you know, different apartment owners and stuff. And it's certainly a different life. But I always loved to hear the stories that my parents and grandparents told. We would set out on the ranch because we didn't have TV. And radio we got just wasn't real good either. But way we communicated is just like you and I are right now. We sat on the front porch to stay cool in the summertime and sat around the fireplace in the wintertime. But we told the family told stories, and my grandmother and my aunts and uncles, they would visit often, and we all sat around and twiddled our thumbs, as they say, and told stories. And I really enjoyed the other stories that my family would tell me, and I didn't believe a lot of them. They were just too far-fetched, like a little boy, one of the my grandmother's little cousins getting captured by Indians in Austin, Texas on January the 21st of 1841. It was hard for me to imagine what that would have been like. At the time I heard the story the first time, I was about 9 years old, same age as a child. So that kind of tweaked my interest, and I wanted to learn more.
Well, let's hold it there momentarily, David, because I want to go back and dial back to the first in the Westwood sagas. That, of course, is Spring House, book one in the Westwood saga series. And I'm particularly keen to actually develop this because in terms of the description, we have the Mitchell family left Lancaster, Pennsylvania in 1762 to go to North Carolina. So, Jessica, you are obviously originally from North Carolina, and of course you're on the Author of the Week there. Currently, you're in Dublin. Again, this book, which was, again, chronicled by David Bowles, a descendant of the Mitchell family, beginning when 17-year-old Adam Mitchell arrives in North Carolina with his family. So I suspect, Jessica, you might have one or two questions to put to David about that whole North Carolina experience.
Yeah, it's awesome whenever I get to hear about a book that includes North Carolina. I feel like we're a bit of an overlooked state. Did you kind of go to North Carolina to get a bit of a gauge of the area to write in your book?
Yes, I did. I had quite a great time there. I knew that my ancestor fought in the American Revolution with the Brits, as you well know, and General Cornwallis came through and destroyed their farm. I didn't know that until I went to Guilford Courthouse National Park, Military Park, and started inquiring, and I found out there that the Mitchell family lived right there where the battle took place. And if you've ever been to the military park there at Guilford Courthouse, they call it Guilford Courthouse. And if you wonder about the name Guilford Courthouse, they built a courthouse there and there was no town. So for lack of a name, they just called it Guilford Courthouse. It was just a place to go file your records in a log cabin sort of thing. But the family they lost their farm. I mean, they had to leave it because all his bodies buried in their farm. They just didn't want to farm it anymore. And they moved west. And that's why people say this happened in North Carolina. How is this part of the Westward sagas? Well, in 1760, when they moved down there, it was going west. And they later moved on to Tennessee and kept moving west. And that's how the story goes. But quite a bit in North Carolina around the battle and some of the places I went. I'm trying to think of the names of some of those little areas up there. But it's where the three states come together in Grandfather Mountain. I'm sure you've been to Grandfather Mountain.
Yeah.
I went up at Grandfather Mountain, and I tell you, if we got time to tell you a cute story, I was younger than Jessica, and I am right now. This was about 20 years ago, and I was walking quite a bit and hiking, and I decided I was going to walk from Greensboro, North Carolina, over to Jonesboro. I thought that would be, and going right across the mountain, like they had to go across that mountain. And my publicist at the time just kind of laughed and says, "You better research that and try and go over that road." And I realized that over that road at Grand Papa Mountain, there's no place to walk except in the road. And 18-wheelers come through there. So I didn't do that. I didn't do that little stunt, but I would have loved to pull it off. But
they didn't worry about 18-wheelers in their time. That was not a concern for them.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't have a problem then going across the mountains and packing what they had. And the interesting thing is that Adam Mitchell carried the cannonball that destroyed his house with him across that mountain. And it was in his will when he died in Jonesboro, Tennessee, which was originally, Tennessee was originally part of North Carolina. A lot of people don't remember that, but, and I
I
don't
didn't
either.
know
It's
that.
totally.
I learned something new.
Yeah. Well,
Have you always had this interest in American history and kind of migration in the US?
I have since I was a young boy, like I was just telling Alex, but we sat around talking and telling stories, and I really took an interest to it, and that was one of the subjects that I exceeded in, and everything else I pretty well just was pretty mediocre on. But history was something I really enjoyed, and that, like I say, starting that book and Springhouse, I originally had wrote the book in another direction. I'd started about when they came to Texas, and I went to a great author who lived in Austin. His name H.W. Brand. You may hear him on a History Channel from time to time. And I wanted to try and convince him to write this book for me because I'd never written anything that's a newsletter and a few things. And I wanted a professional writer. And he advised me two things. Number one, that I should write it because I knew the stories. And I knew the characters, and they were in my head and in my heart. And he said, no one else can do that but you. And the other reason he said, he told advice he gave me is he says, you need to dig deeper for your roots. You need to find out those guys that came to Texas back in 1836. You need to find why they came to Texas, and you'll have yourself a series. And that's what I did. I went backwards in my research, but I first, and that's really the way you have to do it in genealogy is start with grandparents, great grandparents, and just keep moving back.
David,
So
you're the fifth generation of your family to be born in Austin, Texas, but a fascinating fact for me at least was noting that your great grandmother, Elnora Van Cleve, was actually the first child born in Austin, Texas, on April 14th, 1841. Now, in some instances, that's actually only several generations back. I would say five generations in essence. So, clearly the world was a completely different place then. I mean, it was 20 years before the American Civil War, and yet, in some instances, we kind of almost view it as almost ancient history now.
well, I it's amazing. My family was in Texas 100 years before I was born, so you can do the math and figure out how old I am. So, the family's been in Texas for 100, going on 180 years now, and we have eighth generation now in my family. I have two grandsons and two great grandsons. So yeah, the family goes on. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to tell the story, because I have to tell you that when my parents told the stories, they got a, they told down to generation to generation. They were so turned around on some of them. But the basic thing was right. It was grandmother used to tell us, told all everybody that her grandfather built the state capitol in Austin, Texas. Well, the only capitol I ever knew is the one that stands at 11th and Congress Avenue, and you see it on TV all the time. People can't get a good picture of the United States Capitol, so they take a picture of the Texas Capitol. If it's a pink building, it's not the United States Capitol, it's the Texas Capitol, and they look identical, except ours is 3 foot taller, of course. We've got to brag a little bit. The story about my grandfather building it. I went to school, fourth grade. We went on a school trip, and I kept telling my teacher that my grandmother told me that my grandfather built the Capitol in Austin. And she said, well, that's great. You get your documentation together, give me a report on it, and I'll give you an extra grade. When I started doing the research, he was Elnora's father. His name was Lorenzo Van Cleve. I couldn't find one word about him having anything to do with building the Capitol. And I went to the library that was in the Capitol at that time to get information. And somebody told me, said, well, you know, maybe he worked on the other Capitol, or maybe he was just a worker. And I found out that the workers that they used were the convicts from Convict Hill. They moved the masonry to rock and stuff to set in place for that Capitol. But I inherited Elnora's Bible. And in that Bible, there were a lot of documents. And I found one where Lorenzo Van Cleve had done all this work for the Republic of Texas, which was a republic, was his own sovereign nation. And he did build the first Capitol in Austin. And it was I would call it a little wooden shack. It was very small, probably 20 by 20, two different rooms, 20 by 20. And that was for the House of Representatives, which they didn't have very many then because there were only about 16 counties. And now we have 254. But that's the story turned, and I found the documentation, and he was given 1,280 acres of land for building not only the Capitol, but other federal buildings when he decided to move the Capitol to Austin. It was originally in Houston. But he did build the Capitol, but it wasn't this majestic-looking granite stone building that I expected it to be. But he did build it, and he was a known carpenter. I think he probably did most of the fancy work because he was a cabinet maker, and more than a carpenter, he was a cabinet maker. But it was a pretty crude building, and of course it no longer exists, and I'm real disappointed that Austin doesn't have a marker there for where the first capital permanent capital in the Republic of Texas was. But I want to tell you something else. I had the opportunity to be in London in the 80s, and I was representing Berry Brothers and Rudd in the United States. I know you know that name very well, Scotch and gin and stuff. I was in the alcoholic beverage business, and they took me over on St. James Street to a place that was the embassy of the Republic of Texas back in the 1840s when Texas was a sovereign nation. And it's still there. And there's a plaque on the wall that said, here was the Texas embassy. And I did some research on that. It had nothing to do with my family or my books, but was interested to find out that James Pinckney Henderson was the ambassador, who later became the first governor of Texas. And he resided there, and they had to have an office. They had to have an address, and it wasn't Berry Brothers and Rudd's offices at that time, but that's where Berry Brothers and Rudd headquarters, as far as I know, still is at number 5 St. James Street. And there was a Republic of Texas there, and Great Britain was one of the first to recognize Texas. France was first, and then Great Britain was the second nation to recognize the Republic of Texas as a nation.
The Lone Star State.
Little Texana in London.
I mean, allowing for that, clearly we start off, as you say, Pennsylvania to North Carolina in Springhouse, Book 1. We then have Adam's Daughters, Book 2 in the Westwood Saga, followed rapidly by Children of the Revolution, Book 3, and Comanche Trace, Book 4, with the fifth one obviously coming up. It's often said that history is one system of beliefs replacing another system of beliefs. And I'm sure, David, you'll be well aware of the revisionist history that often is very popular in terms of academic circles and so on, and for some good reason as well, in terms of reorienting the history of this. And I certainly think that you've done an excellent job in terms of how the migration actually occurred. Were you ever tempted to look at the viewpoint of the Native Americans, or was that a case of you feel, no, we'll ignore that completely?
No, No, I've studied. There's nothing to be said that the land was taken away from them. They were moved out. It's interesting to note, though, that those Indi the Indians that many of the Indians immersed into the to the Anglo's way once they came over across the pond, and they did very well. Some of them did very well, but there is no doubt about it, they were shortchanged. But you have to realize the reason that they could never have ever really integrated to the point that living together, and the big thing was land. And the issue is when the Indians believed that all Indians owned the land. You couldn't, no one could just own a piece of land. These guys were coming over from Ireland and England and Germany and all over, and coming in to the United States. And in Texas, we had lots of Indians. And they just couldn't understand. They would say, "Hey, your teepees are on my land. Get off my land." That was a way everybody was protective of the land, even though they didn't have fencing in the early days of open range. But the Indians couldn't comprehend that someone could own a piece of land. The land belonged to the sky. And in my book, Adam's Daughters, there's an old Indian chief that told the story that, the white man was trying to tell him. This Adam Mitchell, my ancestor, was trying to explain to him he was living on his land. And he says, "How can it be your land? Do you own the water, and that sort of thing?" And then there's a cute story in Adam's Daughters about this. The neighbors built a dam on the river where the Indians fished and hunted, that sort of thing, and they dammed it up to have their own water and have a grist mill. And the old Indian just came in there and got his mules and horses, and they pulled the rocks out and broke the dam. Adam Mitchell goes down there and, "Why did you bust our dam?" "Well, you're stopping up the river. If the fish can't flow down, we can't have water." And, Adam tried very hard to make him understand that that land was his. The Indian had no idea what he was talking about. And that was the big problem with the Indian situation, and why land ownership. If the Americans had come over here and said, "Well, we'll just share this land," I mean, the English and the Germans and all that came over, if they tried to share the land, and then they did a kind of terrible way of doing it when they started the reservations. And I always tell people, if you want to know how socialism works, I'm trying to get political, but you want to know how socialism works, go to a reservation and you'll find out how well socialism works in America. But that's kind of my thoughts on the Indians. They got a tough ride. They're doing very well here now because in Oklahoma, most of them have reservations that are sitting on a lot of oil. And
Which is another whole other area for discussion and debate. I mean, it does seem somewhat disappointing that as a human species, as indeed is being demonstrated at present within the Ukraine, that people have this obsession with indeed land. And somehow, I must admit, David, I do have probably more sympathy with the Native American viewpoint that actually, why should you actually own the land? But that's a different line for another debate. Jessica, let's turn to yourself. Any questions you'd like to put to David now about life and times, or indeed, what maybe your teachers never told you about George Washington?
George Washington. I think I'd like to know more about how you started writing and kind of why you decided to start writing this.
I'm glad you asked that question because I have to really think about that. And the reason I started writing this story is I couldn't find anybody to write it for me. I went to several people. I told you about H.W. Brand. I went to a fellow by the name of Cecil Murphy, and he's written over 150 books. His name's only on about half of them. He's written them. One of them he did the book, the biography of Franklin Graham. That's one of them. He's pretty well known. And his name is actually on it. Franklin Graham has told to Cecil Murphy. And Cecil, when I approached him at a writer's conference, telling him I was looking for somebody to write this series. I wanted him to write it in such a way that it could easily be converted to a miniseries, because it's a 100-year journey. It could make a long, long series. And he said the same thing to me that H.W. Brand did. He says, "You got to write this book. Nobody can write it but you." And I first wrote it not as a novel. I first wrote the stories about the facts that I'd found, everything about the Battle of Guilford Courthouse, and very factual, a number of people that died, and how many wounded, and, you know, how many acres of land they fought on, and that sort of thing, which doesn't make a very good story. It gives some facts, but it doesn't make a very good story. And someone finally told me one day, he says, "Why don't you write a series like the little I don't know if you're aware of it, but, well, sure you are, Jessica, but the book, I'm trying to think of the lady's name right now, Little House on the Prairie.
Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Laura Ingalls. She's been dead for many years. But that story is still, it was made into a TV documentary and that sort of thing. And he again told me, he said, "You need to make a series out of this. You can't put it in one book. You just can't, you know, too many characters." And so I just started writing it, and I started going to writers groups. And I'm talking about 25 years ago, sitting around, and they were talking about things I didn't have a clue what they were talking about. But I began to pick up on it, and I wrote it as I could. I had my work critiqued by writers groups. I wasn't afraid to put it out there and see what they'd say, you know, and my research was really good, but I did my research, and then I tried to put too much research into some of my stories, and I had a good editor, and she helped me, and I learned about them, you know, they had to make their own soap. And are you aware, Jessica, how they made what soap was made from back in the day?
Animal fat.
Yep. And I wanted to find out how they did that. So I actually found out where they were having a seminar on making soap. I went to it, and it just tell you how I had to get away from this technical stuff. I was so proud of all this stuff. So during this period of time, I wrote up at about 3 pages in a chapter about how Mitchell family made their soap and boiled the hog lard and that sort of thing. My editor cut those 3 pages down to one sentence, and it says, "They made soap."
Oh, no.
So sometimes I did a little bit too much research that, you know, just doesn't fit in the book, doesn't carry along the story. But I've learned a lot, and over 20 years of writing now, and I've written about 150 short stories that have been published, and I have quite a few in my blog. I think we have 454 little short stories. You can go to westwardsagas.com and look at some of the stories about my grandfather and some funny stories that happened, and things were quite different in Texas, even during my time. I was the first family. I was the first born in a hospital in my line, and one of the first to live in a house that had running water. So, but I'm old, and I'll tell you, my grandkids used to crawl up my lap and say, "Grandpa, tell me about the good old days." I said, "Son, you live in them." Because I don't think I'd want to live back then. And I've got to tell you, though, about a book. I want to show you this, Children of the Revolution. That's about the children that were on that battlefield the day that Cornwallis came through. And in this book, is about half of it is a, takes place in London. Peggy ends up in London, Alex, of all places, and sailed in there with a load of furs. And she meets, she has some problems. And the only person that could help her was General Cornwallis. And this is a fictional story now, but she was there. Cornwallis was there, whether they got together or not. But they become friends. And it's a great thing about reconciliation. This woman grew up to hate the British, to hate General Cornwallis for destroying her home. And she saw all the dead bodies in the aftermath of the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. And it turns into a great love story. She falls in love over there. And it's quite an interesting story. And I'm really disappointed that I haven't sold a lot of books in the UK. But it's available on Amazon. Just have to put my little pitch in for that one. I thought, what can I tell the folks over there about the children of the revolution? And it, Alex, it tells both sides. And I think I did a very good job of making it fair. General Cornwallis, amazing to me in my research, is that after he lost the war, I just, like everyone else in America, assumed he went back and, you know, they just kind of pushed him aside and said, oh man, you know, you lost the war. But the king immediately made him what we would call a secretary of war. I think they call it, at that time, they appointed him to the master of the armory or something like that. But it's the same equivalent to secretary of war. But it makes a great story. And they have a party. General Cornwallis takes them to a restaurant that I went to back in the 80s, and it's still operating. It was operating when Peggy was in London, and it opened, I believe, on New Year's Eve of 1790 something. I can't. But do y'all know who that restaurant, where that restaurant is, and what it, the name of that restaurant is? Alex, I bet you know.
You're going to have to enlighten us. It has to be said.
It's the restaurant that makes the rules. Rules Restaurant, right down by, not 10 blocks away from the offices of John Dewar's, Dewar's and Company, Dewar Scotch.
Which brings us full circle. We haven't really got the chance to talk about the fact that you were the Business Leader of the Year for the Greater San Antonio Chamber of Commerce in 1994. Wow. You've got a lifetime membership, of course, to the Texas Association of Business. If you were pushed, would you prefer to be acknowledged as a writer or a businessman?
Well, for the last 20 years, I still belong to several business organizations, including the Texas Association of Business. I don't go to as many meetings as I used to, but you know, I turned my business over to my daughter about 20 years ago, and I am so glad that I did that, because she's just done wonderful with it, and I walked away and never turned back on it. I let her tend to her business. She calls me every once in a while for advice, not as often as she used to, but I'm totally out of it, and I'm 100% an author, and I introduced myself as an author, and yes, I was very proud of my company and what we did back in the 90s, and I was really honored to be the Octoneer of the Year for Greater San Antonio Chamber of Commerce. It was quite a deal, and I was very active in a political arena, and I worked on a lot of causes for small business people and things that we needed, like water. We have some tremendous water issues in Texas, and at the moment we're going through the worst drought that we've had in 100 years. And water is a really big issue, and I've been interested in that and a lot of other things. But I knew my way around the state capitol pretty well because, heck, my great 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 granddaddy built it.
Absolutely. Now, we also have to ask the question, does it matter in which order you read the Westwood sagas? Should you start off with book one and progress following that with book two, book three, book four? Or if you actually say, I'm going to jump in straight away with Comanche Trace, that's the one for me. Or indeed the fifth one, which is coming out obviously in the spring.
That's right. It really doesn't matter because each stands on their own, Alex. And I took that into consideration. I found that people who really get into it like to start at the first book because the characters, you can grow up with this girl, Peggy, who is one of my main characters. A lot of people think my books are about war, they're about men. Actually, when it gets right down to it, nearly every generation, it's about the protagonist is a female, one of my female ancestors, and my like Eleanor. She was just a baby when she was, 1841. And she grew up, she had 14 children. Can you imagine that?
We're going to have a few spares, although perhaps I shouldn't say spare, given Prince Harry's propensity for that at present, but there we are. We've reached a stage where we need to ask those last two questions, apart from saying, of course, that you can access more details about David Bowles by going to westwoodsagas.com. That's westwoodsagas.com. Jessica, would you like to put those last two questions to David, please?
Yeah. So have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Have I had an interesting what, ma'am?
A Zoom with us today.
Oh, a Zoom, yes. I'm telling you, this is something that's kind of new to me. I used to have to get in a car and drive 300 miles to a little radio station out in the country to do an interview. This is pretty cool sitting at my desk here.
Excellent.
And especially across the pond, I can see, Alex, this is the first time I've done it, done a Zoom across the pond.
Well, that's what telecommunications is all about, David, and certainly at the heart of Siren Radio. So I take it then you'd be kind enough to return and share with us more about the mythologies of the West and indeed the real life histories of the West and indeed the Bowles family legacies. Would you be kind enough to come back?
I'd love that. I'd love that. And I want you to go see. I want you to go see that where the Texas embassy was.
We will have to check that out. And we'll put that on our list of things to do. We'll ask several of our London correspondents to do that. For the moment, David Bowles, huge thanks. Actually, David, do you have any particular music? We launched with a track by the band Kansas and Dust in the Wind, which I thought was particularly apt. Any particular, do you want Yellow Rose of Texas or would you like something more prosaic in terms of your final choice of music?
How about Mama Don't Let Your Cowboy, Don't Let Your Boys Grow Up to Be Cowboys by Willie Nelson.
Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive them old trucks. Make them be doctors and lawyers and such. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. They'll never stay home and they're always alone, even with someone they love. Cowboys ain't easy to love and they're harder to hold. And they'd rather give you a song than diamonds and gold. Long Star Bell buckles and old faded Levi's, and each night begins a new day. And if you don't understand him and he don't die young, he'll probably just ride away. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive. Come be doctors and lawyers and such. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. They'll never stay home and they're always alone, even with someone they love. Fairmount morning. Little warm puppies and children and girls of the night. And them that don't know him won't like him, and them that do sometimes won't know how to take him. He ain't wrong, he's just different, but his pride won't let him do things to make you think he's right. They'll never stay home, and they're always alone, even with someone they love. Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them pick guitars and drive them. Make them be doctors and lawyers and such.
Carry on my son, there'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest, don't you cry no more. Beyond this illusion, I was soaring ever higher.